Internet Talk Radio. Planet Earth. This is TalkZone.com. Time for more of the Bob Woodson Show, What Works and Why, on TalkZone.com.
This is Bob Woodson again, and you're listening to the Bob Woodson Show, What Works and Why. Our guests are Matthew Spaulding, author of the book We Still Hold These Truths, and Bill Shamba, director of the Hudson Institute's Bradley Center of Philanthropy and Civic Renewal. So it is precisely this patronizing attitude. In fact, Kimmy Gray, who's now deceased, used to say that the worst thing that I face isn't malice or anger from another individual, is when they treat me like I'm a child.
Right.
There is nothing more insulting to a person to say that they are too innocent to know what is in their own interest, and therefore someone else has to deliver you from yourself.
Mm-hmm. No, and that is the whole concept of modern progressivism and the modern state, if you will. But use an earlier example, much closer to the founders themselves. The founders understood that by juxtaposing independence and dependence. Independence they saw as a virtue, self-reliance, responsibility, self-government. And they were very concerned about dependence and being dependent upon government especially, which later comes out in the great warning of Alexis de Tocqueville in Democracy America, in which he talks about what happens when you combine two things. One is a desire to make everything equal, to make it equal. To bring it about, you desire that passion for that equality, that egalitarianism, with a centralization. Precisely, if you think about it in terms of the professionalization of the social service we were talking about, you continue to centralize that into one powerful authority. If you combine that powerful authority with this desire to make things all equal, he said that might be a new form of despotism. And the reason it is, it's not because it's hard, and it's not because of the laws themselves. But because government treats everyone like children, and government becomes like it's the parent, and it's just it captures really the exactly what you said, which is that it becomes patronizing in the worst way, and this destroys our character, and because it destroys our character, it means we can no longer govern ourselves. And I think that's precisely what the founders understood when they put us on this mission to bring about self-governance. We can't guarantee it. We don't know if this will work. But this is what true liberty means.
And Bill, I appreciate that. And one of the challenges to funders and others, government officials, who are trying to help is precisely that they really act with noble intentions.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
I think it was Dietrich Bonhoeffer in his letters from prison said he named several human traits that are difficult to confront. And he was the one who said malice can be confronted with violence. But the most difficult phenomena to challenge is folly.
Mm.
When someone believes they are acting in your best interest.
Right.
You know, that's why it is a term to shrike. There was a movie some years ago, Jose Ferrer, about he was an actor, remember, in a mental institution, and his wife would visit him every day, and she said, "I just love him," and all. And the psychiatrist said, "You ought to be in here, not him, because you are an enabler. You are not allowing him to stand on his own. You are destroying him mm-hmm. with your love."
Right.
And that's exactly what I think Bill struggles with in his position, trying to convince funders and philanthropists to perhaps look at a new way. Am I right, Bill?
Oh, yeah. It's especially in the world of foundations and philanthropy and certainly in government, the problem always is how do you raise questions about these programs, these scientific programs, social scientific programs, that are there with the best of intentions. You know, they've been instituted by folks who have gone into social work often with, you know, every desire to be helpful to folks in the you know, in low income neighborhoods, and yet it turns out that they end up, as you say, Bob, infantilizing the folks in the neighborhood. You know, and the people we're talking about have been, you know, they're all serviced up, right? I mean, they have been subjected to every kind. It's not that we're not spending enough programs or directing enough professional services to these folks. These are people who have, you know, Kimmy Gray was living, you know, prior to her sort of self-liberation. She was living in the heart of the social service empire, right? I mean, everything there was provided, albeit, you know, not very well, by one form of administrative entity or another. And, you know, it is that sort of awakening to that, the insult of that kind of treatment. And is, you know, Matt, going back to Matt's earlier point, there's a discovery of eternal truths here as well. I mean, when you know, I'm sure Kimmy became very tired of that kind of relativistic tolerance of anything goes in the neighborhood, because, you know, Bob's citing the story, you know, but poor people can't afford that kind of patronizing. Poor people can't afford to pay for windows. There's this rediscovery of the essential moral truths that go into the formation of human character. That, as Matt pointed out, you know, the founders were tapped into those eternal truths, and that's really what you know recreates those. What recreates these self-governing communities, generation after generation.
I think one other example from recent history. One of the things that one of the reasons that this Kenilworth Parkside became so civic environment of change is because if someone violated the rules of peace, they were expelled. They were, right, they were put out. And she put this family out because the oldest son continued to deal drugs out of their house, and the mother permitted it. So they put the family out. And so what happens, the family then became homeless. So then they went to the ACLU and said they're homeless, and therefore the housing authority is required to tell Mrs. Gray and other residents that they have to give priority to homeless people in admitting people to the development, because homeless people have a right, mm-hmm, to housing. And so when this person presented themselves armed with the American Civil Liberties Union to say they want to be place on the priority that the next admission has to be this family, Ms. Gray took 25 of her residents down to the court and said, here is the police record of this family,
right,
and they are not coming in back into our development until they change their behavior. I don't care what the law says or what your policies say. We are not having that family come in. What lesson would we be, message would we be sending to all the other families that if they knew that their rights overshadowed their responsibilities to be a good neighbor? And we cannot teach that lesson to our people.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was always these kind of conflicts between civil libertarians, some of them saying, dealing with people's rights. And they have stripped responsibility from rights that they don't not even discuss at the same place and at the same time. But the resident leaders, in order to bring about the civil change and improvement, this became fundamental to the way they conducted their lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
No, that's a great, another great story. These are all great stories that I'm just amazed how often it kind of, you know, proves in living proof of these common notions that you see going back to America's founding and throughout really the long tradition of American history. One of the problems we have today is that the balance of rights and responsibilities, which I think was absolutely crucial to the founders' understanding of how self-government would work, has been divided and torn apart by an overemphasis on a very abstract, you know, kind of legalistic notion of rights, which at the end of the day is based on a notion of I have a right to do whatever I want to do. And the whole notion of responsibility, which, you know, carries the great baggage of moral character, that behavior matters, that these things make a difference. And we want good character because we need good citizens. That notion is now seen as being, you know, old-fashioned and virtually worthless anymore. But again, you have to keep in mind what's pushing that. It's the same problem. It's the progressive state. The only way you can centralize all these activities that you're talking about professionally into government is that government becomes more and more neutral when it comes to the questions of your behavior. Because that's the only way you can do it in this scientific way that applies to everyone. Oh, we can't make moral judgments. Whereas we need those judgments, and you need to do it precisely on the basis of your example, which is that communities, they know what's going on. They know what's going on over there. And that is not going to stand. No. And government can't do that. And when it tries, the only way it can do it is by stepping out of precisely the kinds of responsibility questions that are crucial for saving these communities.
Now, some of our critics will say, well, you're against all regulations, all standards. No, I think there should be some correlation between certification and qualification.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see any relationship when I'm talking about drug addiction, crime, violence, a lot of the social disorders that we're seeing. I don't want someone who puts a shingle out and says, I'm a doctor.
Right.
Come on in, get your brain surgery. No,
right,
there
right.
is some relationship.
In and out same day.
Out the same day, there's some relationship between certification and qualification. So we're not saying doing away with all regulation. We're saying has to be demonstrated that there is a relationship between the certification and the qualification. Am I right?
Right. Yeah, the way certification is used today, of course, in professional service providing activities, is it's a way of denying the agency of folks in the neighborhood. I mean, it without those qualifications, without some kind of degree from a school, you're not able to understand the problems that are in front of you. You know, Kimmy Gray isn't really able to understand the complex social dynamics impacting neighborhoods today and all this stuff. And if only she had gone to Georgetown and gotten a degree in social work, maybe she could do some of that stuff, but she didn't. It's that, yeah, I think that the certification process is just a dramatically disabling tool in the inner city. And anytime people talk about taking over their own lives and running their own affairs, this notion of the lack of expertise, as Matt says, the lack of uniformity, it's not fair. Why should, how can this community establish its own sort of unique standards, because that violates, equal protection? I mean, there are all sorts of ways we have of disabling neighborhoods from governing themselves. But it really is, that malady can be traced back to the progressive movement. And I think, one of the wonderful things about the work underway at the Heritage Foundation is that they're really zeroing in on this source of an awful lot of the problems that we face.
There's another myth, too, that comes into play here. It's amazing how we associate formal education with character.
Mm.
I remember when the president of American University was fired for making pornographic phone calls, and interview after interview. I don't know how he did that. He has a PhD from Harvard. and we really do make these judgments, and that's why a lot of our appeals to people to change their behavior through drug ads and all, an egg frying on a skillet, as if drug addiction is rational.
Right.
If it were a rational process that rational people could listen to and adhere to, you wouldn't have pharmacologists, doctors, psychologists who are drug addicts.
Right.
It wouldn't, because they know the dangers of it, but it is something about their character that prevents them from acting on their knowledge.
That's absolutely right. And it goes back to this question about what do we understand to be about human nature? The modern notion of human nature, which ties precisely in with progressives, is that it's it's purely rationality. So we got to teach it and educate it and enlighten it, and this will solve all our problems. The better understanding of human nature, which is just patently obvious if you think about it for a moment and hear any stories like the ones you're telling, is that human nature is a person made up of a mix of passions and yes, rationality, but more passions and things that shape their character and all of those things, which suggests that education is not merely an intellectualization, but character development. And it's done through understanding these deep meanings that you get from living your life in your community and through your experience.
And that's going to be the last word. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank
really
you.
Enjoyed the dialogue. Our guests today have been Matthew Spaulding, author of the new book, We Still Hold These Truths, and William Schamber, director of the Hudson Institute's Bradley Center for Philanthropy and Civic Renewal. Next week, we will continue to explore some of these issues troubling our schools and communities and talk to some of the people who are actually solving problems and have thought some of these through. I'm Bob Woodson, President, Center for Neighborhood Enterprise. Please join us next week at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Listen to the show and access past programs. Go to www.cneonline.org and click on the radio icon. If you'd like to comment on the show or send us your story ideas, please email us at bwoodsonshow@cneonline.org. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you'll be with us each week on The Bob Woodson Show, What Works and Why.
You've been listening to The Bob Woodson Show, What Works and Why, insights and solutions to some of America's most troubling societal problems, featuring community activist Robert L. Woodson Sr. To learn more, visit cneonline.org. And join us next time for more of The Bob Woodson Show, right here on TalkZone.com.